Hello there, guys, gals, and non-binary pals, and welcome to the NeuroCuriosity Club podcast, the only podcast that I'm aware of that is specifically made for people who are questioning their neurotype and their place in the neurodiversity paradigm. My name is Megan. I am AudiHD, so I'm autistic and ADHD, but this podcast is going to be about so much more than that. Yes, there are going to be lots of autism and ADHD episodes because that's my lived experience. That's what I can speak to. But I also plan on having so many amazing guests on this podcast to talk about everything from dyspraxia to OCD to bipolar disorder to dyscalculia and more. So if you are curious about your brain, get ready to dive in. Welcome to the NeuroCuriosity Club podcast. Hi there, Tina. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm so good. How are you?
I'm great. I am so thrilled that you could be here. I'm really excited about our topic today.
Me too. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm so excited to dive into it with you.
Yay. Okay. So first, before we dig into everything, let's introduce you to the audience. So I know this is the most annoying question in the world, but tell us about yourself.
Yes. So my name is Tina Etheridge. I'm a radical ADHD and AutiHD acceptance coach. So I work with both ADHD and autistic and ADHD clients. I personally am AutiHD, which has been a lifetime journey of discovery, which I feel like it has been for so many neurodivergent folks. First discovering that I am ADHD and all of the like mind-blowing realizations of that when I was, I think, about 28. And then a couple years later, going on a self-discovery, self-diagnosis journey of autism and realizing like, oh my gosh, yes, I very much am autistic. And so I've been a coach for, I think, 3 or 4 years now. And yeah, that's me.
I love it. That's amazing. Yeah, I think a lot of people listening relate to the lifelong discovery journey. Yeah. Yeah. So quick question before we dive into our topic, just kind of off topic, but were there other labels that you found first that you've since realized are less helpful or less accurate?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Including diagnostic labels, right? I had been labeled as a grieving person, right? That's why I'm so chronically depressed, is it's just grief. It's just, I lost my mom when I was very young. And so I had a lot of therapists, psychologists, psychiatrists be like, oh, you're just still grieving your mom. And I would be like, okay, like, yeah, but like, maybe there's something else going on here.
But like, how do you say that? How do you say like, no, I'm actually not that sad about
that?
Well,
I didn't.
Obviously is not
what
you're saying.
No, right. But that's exactly it. I didn't, right? Because I was like, yes, you are the expert. So surely you must know it. I just need to dig deeper to try to figure that out. Because of course, at that time in my life, I had no idea that I was ADHD, autistic. Like that was not even remotely on my radar. It was just depression. And of course, being on antidepressants and having that experience of like, this literally doesn't help me feel any better at all. What's up with that? Okay, must be me. Must be my brain. I just need to try harder. I just need to read more self-help books. I just need more therapy. But just that barrier and that struggle. And then much later in life, I was going to grad school for my master's in bioinformatics. I was like a year in. And then I was also working full-time, like 40-hour weeks. And like my autistic experience is such that I feel like in my life, I can do one thing really well, and then everything else drops off the deep end, right? But that one thing I'm going to do really, really well. And so for the first time in my life, I had two things to juggle at the same time that were very demanding. And I was struggling. I was suffering so hard. My mental health, my anxiety was just off the charts. And so I sought help. And that's when I first got another depression diagnosis. Meds didn't work. I looked for another doctor, and that's when I got a bipolar diagnosis. And for me, that was like, you know, at first I was like, oh my gosh, thank God. Like, oh, okay. I finally have a reason. I have an explanation for why years of my life, nothing's been working. But unfortunately for me, that was not the correct diagnosis, and the medication, right? It just wasn't right for my brain chemistry, and it's not accurate for me. And so the medication I was on made things like 100 times worse, which, you know, deep end, rock bottom, really, really tough. Which of course prompted me to be like desperate for another answer, to be like, there has to be something else. And that's when I figured out ADHD and that journey.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing. It's always comforting to me to hear people who've had a bit of a winding path to get here, because I know mine also included a bipolar misdiagnosis. And yeah, and for me, the depression is very real. Like, there's very clearly some depression biochemistry going on in my brain, because the antidepressants work fucking wonders. But they don't make me not ADHD or not autistic. They just make me not depressed, which is a godsend, believe me. But it's not the whole story. So yeah. Cool. Okay. So our main topic for today, though, is something that I have not seen anyone else talk about. So please feel free to reference people who've inspired you, of course, but you're the first person I've seen put it this way. And I love this like framework. So we're going to be talking about ADHD harm reduction. And that's like the super unique concept that I'm fascinated to hear your thoughts on. And then also radical self-acceptance, which goes hand in hand with harm reduction. But also radical self-acceptance is a big tenet of like DBT therapy and all that good stuff. So that one I've heard about, and I've heard of harm reduction, but ADHD harm reduction, like, oh my gosh, tell me how you came to this.
Okay. So years ago, I had read the book How to Keep House While Drowning by Casey Davis. I'm sure you've heard of her. She's amazing. She's an incredible therapist and the book is incredible. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend it. Because it's like such a beautiful book in the way that it is written. It is so well written for neurodivergent brains and like chronically ill brains and depressed brains and like all of the things, because the chapters, like, it's a tiny book. The chapters are like 1 to 2 pages long. So it's not like, you know, when you're like reading and you're like, wow, this is a 30 page long chapter and my brain has already wandered off. I am gone. What did I just read? Like, it's not like that. And it is such a compassionate and so, oh my gosh. Anyway, it's an amazing book and reading it blew my mind in so many ways. But the book is specifically about, right? The title is How to Keep House While Drowning. How lovely. Like, yes, yes. Oh my gosh. Yes. You hear that title and you're like, wow. But the book is about like care tasks, household tasks, chores, and how to support your brain in doing things like that when it feels really, really hard. But I read this book and my mind was blown as I was reading it, because I was like, oh my gosh, this is not just about chores and home tasks and care tasks. Like, yes, it is. But like the same exact principles can be applied to work. It can be applied to like, I don't know, just like literally everything, like your art practice. It can be applied to literally all the things. It's not just, you know, this one encompassing sort of moment of home care, brushing your teeth, doing laundry. It's like, it's everything. It's absolutely everything. And so, that's truly where I got my inspiration. And, you know, also kind of like going back, you know, learning about addiction and addiction recovery and the sort of idea that for some people, you know, like the 12-step program works really well for them and we love that for them. But for a percentage of people, it does not work very well. Especially I think brains who are prone to all or nothing thinking or perfectionism or, you know, shame, you know, deep, deep shame of, you know, the feeling. I mean, I had this feeling my whole life of being like, okay, here's this thing I want to do and I have to do it perfectly, or I have to do it every single day. You know, especially for me being entrenched in diet culture when I was much younger, it would be this sort of experience like, all right, like today is the day I'm going to, you know, basically like not eat, my eating disorder journey, like not eat anything at all. And have this idea in my brain that like, okay, I'm going to lose weight and I'm going to like do all these exercises and I'm doing every single day. And then I wouldn't, because surprise, you can't starve yourself infinitely. And then I would be in this shame spiral of like, oh my gosh, I broke my streak. I messed up. And all of these just like toxic, really harsh, harmful sort of ideas of like how we should be in the world, which I feel like we are so often taught. Like, hey, if you're gonna do this thing, you should do it every day. I think, you know, a lot of times our parents are even the ones who teach us that of like, okay, young child, like you should brush your teeth every day. And like, yeah, that's great. And we love that. But maybe actually we can't brush our teeth every day. If you were a PDA kind of kid, right? If you have that neurotype, maybe you actually can't brush your teeth every day. And so this perfectionism, this all or nothing sort of thinking, my brain is wired that way. My brain is 100% predisposed to be like, I'm either doing it completely right or I'm completely failing and screwing it all up. And so breaking free from that, breaking free from the all or nothing thinking and having a sort of harm reduction approach where, no, I don't have to brush my teeth every day. But if I brush my teeth once every other day, that is still a win, right? I think our culture, our society might look at that and be like, oh, that's not good enough. You should be doing more. But I don't believe that. I don't believe that anymore. I believe that, you know, for in terms of sustainability and not burning out, that this sort of more persistence-based mindset instead of a consistency-based mindset is so much more accessible when your brain is having a hard time.
Yes, yes. Was that you who posted the calendar of like, this is what persistence looks like?
Yes.
Consistency? Heck yes. I loved that post that I was telling Tina before we hopped on. I was like, I'm so glad you could be on the podcast because I feel like every single post you post is a banger. Like, I love them all. So if you don't follow Tina on Instagram yet, where can they follow you?
I'm at Comfort and Kindness on Instagram.
I love it. Okay. Sorry. We'll jump back into the harm reduction. It's just, I loved that post a lot. But yeah, I think our society is really focused on consistency. We think that's really important. And I think that's partially a capitalistic value, you know, like sort of pushing us toward being more machine-like, producing the same thing the same way all the time. But I also think it might be related to just neurotypical brains are more wired for consistency, whereas neurodivergent brains, I call it inchworming. So like neurotypical people move more like snakes. Like, yes, they might go back and forth a little, but they're generally moving forward at a consistent pace. Whereas neurodivergent people, we tend to inchworm where we sort of bunch up and then we burst forward and then we bunch up and then we burst forward.
I love that.
That's our vibe. And when I say neurodivergent, I should be more specific. Generally, I'm speaking about ADHD, ADHD, autistic folks specifically. but yeah. So can you maybe talk a little bit more about what harm reduction is for people who are maybe not super familiar with that term?
Yes, it is the broad concept of making it safe to do less, right? So for example, we might look at our The easiest one for me to go to is household tasks because we all have them. But we might look at our kitchen sink and see a full sink of dishes. And where does our brain automatically go? Oh my gosh, if I'm going to do these dishes, I have to do all of the dishes. That feels so overwhelming. That feels exhausting, like literally exhausting, like more exhausting than running a 10K. My brain simply cannot. And right? That's the feeling. It's real. That is the feeling. And so harm reduction looks like, okay, what feels accessible to my brain, right? Is this internal checking, this internal asking of what feels accessible, what feels doable, what feels possible, what feels safe, right? And in the sort of framework of making it safe to do less, right? Breaking away from that all or nothing thinking. And so that, you know, doing the dishes might look like, you know, if you do this internal check-in, okay, maybe my brain is saying, wow, doing all of these dishes sounds freaking horrible. But if I do just the mugs, like, I don't know, my brain kind of likes doing mugs for whatever reason. Like, that's weird. Okay, brain, but you go, brain, whatever you need. But that sort of idea of like, okay, I'm going to just wash the mugs and that's it, right? And not the sort of idea of like, oh, this is going to be a trick. I'm tricking my brain into being able to do more, doing all of the dishes by just starting with the mugs, right? Not like that, because our brains are way too smart for that for the most part. Works sometimes, not all the times, but right. This idea of being like, okay, what feels safe? What feels doable? What feels accessible? And the understanding that, hey, doing just the mugs, it counts. It counts. It counts. It counts. And the more we break away from the all or nothing, the more we break away from the perfectionism and the sort of feeling like, oh, if I do this, I have to do all of it, right? The more we create safety to come back, right? To persist, to return. And so we might do the mugs and, right, have a not horrible experience, right? Not feel miserable, might maybe not even have a meltdown. Maybe feel like, oh, wow, I did that and it actually was okay. And I listened to this podcast or I watched a movie while I did it or whatever else. And creating that nervous system safety to preserve and protect your positive emotional experiences so that your brain subconsciously, the next time you think about doing the dishes, it remembers, oh, remember, like we did that and, you know, it didn't feel like my soul was being sucked out of me. We did that. And actually, like, we, our nervous system was safe. We did that and we preserved or honored our capacity, our energetic capacity. And by doing this, right, what ends up happening is that we rewire our neural pathways in our brain to be like, oh, hey, like, I remember doing this and it wasn't horrible. So now I feel safe to come back and maybe do a little bit later or a little bit the next day. Or I get to check in with myself and ask what feels accessible, what feels doable, what feels possible, and allowing that to be an intuitive sort of like moment by moment experience.
Yes, I love that. And I love that you're not saying like, oh, do less so that you can do more. Like, yeah. I think that's the common turn of phrase is like, oh,
yeah,
if you give yourself permission to only do a little bit, you'll actually find the motivation to do all of it. And it's like, well, you might, but what does that cost you? Mm-hmm. You know, it might be okay. Cause I know for me, the way that my ADHD works personally, yeah, once I start something, I have the momentum and I can usually keep going and it's fine. But I don't think that should be like the only reason we slow down. I think the harm reduction approach to it is much more about like, you know, honoring those energy levels, honoring not just the energy it takes to complete the task. Cause like I said, once I've got the momentum, I'm good, but the energy it requires to jumpstart the task. Like mm-hmm. sometimes that's a lot and like, it's just not always possible. And just being really respectful of ourselves, I think. And I think that's where we dive into some of the radical self-compassion and everything too.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Right. And that, you know, the thought, the reprogramming that happens when we believe, when we begin to believe that, hey, just doing a little bit is worthy of celebration, right? Mm-hmm. I think so often we deny ourselves celebration because there's all the shoulds, right? Oh, I should have done all the dishes. I should have done all the laundry. I should have done this yesterday. And that just is a missed opportunity to celebrate our wins, right? To celebrate and create, preserve, cultivate more positive emotional experiences, more nervous system safety so that we can do the things that we want to do more sustainably. And again, like you said, it's not about tricking ourselves. You know, if that works for you, like, that's great. Like, if you're listening and that works for you, like, I love that for you. It doesn't work for me. My brain, my PDA brain will like, it's just like, no, oh, this is a trap. This is a trick. You can't get me. You cannot get me. And so I will just not do it at all. But if I go into it with a plan, like an intentional plan, like, hey, brain, this is the plan. This is what we're doing. We're just gonna, if it's a pile of laundry, I'm just gonna do like put my underwear. I have like my underwear in a little bin. So it's super easy. I just toss it in the bin and I might say like, hey, that's all I'm doing. That's it. That is the plan. I'm sticking to the plan because that is what feels accessible in my brain today. And being like truly believing, like I don't have to do more unless I really want to, but I do not have to do more.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, that's really powerful. It's bringing me back to middle school. I was what they called non-compliant with my acne medication routine I was supposed to be doing. And I think there were a couple reasons for that. I think a big part of me resented the idea that that was consistently reinforced by dermatologists that like acne was equivalent to cancer. And like I was, and I think they were trying to be sensitive. They were trying to reinforce the idea that like, we take this seriously. We know this is a big deal to you, but it wasn't a big deal to me. And so it felt like they were making a big deal out of nothing. And I was very confused about like why anyone gave a shit that I had bumps on my face. And I was very like hurt by it. It felt very much like the message was, oh, well, you're super ugly and we're going to fix that for you. And so that was a big reason why I was non-compliant with like the routines I was supposed to be doing. But I think another part of it was probably some of the PDA stuff where it's like, but I have to so I have to do it. I don't think I can do that.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, it's the worst. It's the worst. I've been playing around with PDA stuff for a while. I have no idea if it fits me or not, but it's intriguing and it's sometimes a helpful lens to use. So that's sort of the angle I'm taking at the moment. I try not to claim labels unless I know for sure they fit or feel relatively confident they fit since I've had misdiagnosis experiences in the past.
Oh yeah.
But I find that sometimes it's a helpful lens through which to look at things. So, and I could see how harm reduction would be an amazing tool for PDAers for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And again, breaking away from the all or nothing, asking what feels accessible, what feels doable. And, you know, I feel like so much of what you like just talked about is really relevant with radical self-acceptance, which again, like we said, I think goes hand in hand with all of this, right? The radical self-acceptance element is, it's so interesting. So maybe just some context here, because that's always helpful for my brain. But like the last 3 months, has it been 3 months? I don't even know. Since November, I have been like depressed. And I'm realizing, oh my gosh, again, internal awareness, struggles with executive dysfunction. But like, I actually get depressed every November. So this is probably seasonal depression. And of course, it's like this year that I'm like, oh, this is happening like my whole life. Interesting. Okay. Cool. But I've been feeling really down and I don't have a reason. And that's kind of really what tells me that this is like a chemical thing in my brain of like, I do not have a reason. I love my work. I love my dog. I love my house. I love my life. Like there's, you know, there's been times in the past in my life where I've been really depressed and there has been a very specific reason of like, I am stuck in a job that I hate and I don't know how to get out and I don't know what to do differently, but I don't really feel that way. I think it's just like lack of sunlight and vitamin D. But anyway, kind of like where I've been sitting with this lately has been this feeling like, okay. So what if in my brain, right? I'm not telling you that you should feel this way, but I'm just talking about me right now in this moment. Like, what about if in my brain that there is nothing wrong with me? Like, okay, I'm feeling sad. I'm feeling depressed. And what if that means that there is not actually anything wrong with me for feeling this way? And this idea is so important to me because being, you know, like an autistic teenager, my emotional dysregulation was and continues to be like off the charts intense. My emotions and my emotional experiences, it just feels like every so often I will be in a storm and it is a raging torrential storm and my brain will be so cruel and so mean to me and I will be in the darkness and feeling like everything is terrible and everything is awful and I am awful. And when I'm out of the storm, I can kind of objectively look and say like, oh, like I can see that that's not true. I was just having a really hard brain day. I was having like a really hard time. But in the moment, it is so hard. And I remember having those intense feelings and those intense emotions and being like, this needs to be fixed. This is a problem. I need to stop feeling this way because I am irrational and write all of these labels, crazy. Those are the kind of levels of thoughts that I would have. And so I would go to therapy and I would seek help and I would seek support. And it was kind of like validated, like, yeah, you shouldn't be feeling this way. Like, yeah, this is a problem. Yeah, this needs to be fixed. This needs to be changed. You need to do it differently. And I would try and try and try. I feel like I've tried every cognitive therapy or therapy modality ever, like CBT and DBT and somatic and internal family systems. I tried all the things and none of it ever really helped me. I mean, not to say that it didn't at all. That's a very overgeneralization. But for this specific problem, none of it really helped me feel better. And it was not until I decided, wait, hold up. What if I'm not broken? What if I make sense? What if my feelings make sense? What if my emotional experiences make sense? That for the first time in my life, I began to feel peace. Like for the first time in my life, I began to be like, oh my gosh, like, maybe it's safe to feel exactly the way I'm feeling. And maybe that's completely okay. And that sort of element of radical self-acceptance, it's meant that I've stopped this desperate seeking search to be like, oh my gosh, let me read all of these self-help books. Let me do all these things and try all these tools and techniques to no longer be the way that I am, to feel the way that I am, but truly radical self-accepting and like being like, yes, this is how my brain is wired and my feelings make sense and I make sense. It's so interesting because this has been a place where I've actually been able to ironically make the most change, is under that framework and premise that I am not broken to begin with. I have never been unworthy. I am not unworthy. I am worthy and whole exactly as I am. And that sort of place and, you know, getting curious right now, it's kind of when you want to make changes, it's out of compassionate curiosity or critical curiosity of like, ooh, what happens if, or what does it feel like if I try this instead of that sort of desperate black hole kind of feeling?
so familiar with the black hole. Yes. many an angsty poem written about those exact feelings. Yeah. Oh my gosh. I can't even tell you, like, obviously this is a podcast, so y'all couldn't see me or anything, but when you said, what if I make sense? Like, my whole body like melted. I just, yes, please. Yes. What if I make sense? That's such a beautiful question to ask. I remember way, way back, my very first therapist I ever saw back in college, who, God bless her, she was trying her hardest, but I was almost delusional with pain. Like, that is truly how much pain I was in. I could not freaking see straight. And so she tried so hard. At one point, she made me do an exercise where she's like, okay, I want you to write down like three of your favorite things about yourself on this half of the paper. And I was like, okay. And then on the other half, she's like, okay, now I want you to write three things that like you've done that, you know, you're not super proud of, or things you don't necessarily like as much. And I was like, okay. And she's like, okay, open the paper. So I opened it so that they're side by side. And she's like, I want you to look at each line and recognize that both sides are the same person and both sides are equally worthy. And I was like, stop, like, no, you're wrong. Like, I objectively thought she was nuts. And like, looking back, I feel so much compassion for her because I'm sure she was trying hard, but I was not in a place to hear her loving, healing advice.
Yeah, it's so true though. It's so true though, right? Like, I don't know. I think I had a therapist tell me, it's just so interesting. I feel like it's different when somebody is telling you, hey, like, look at it this way. Hey, you should feel this way about it or try this out. I don't know. It's just different versus when it comes from inside of you, right? Because I had a therapist years ago tell me like, hey, you're just going to have to live with like your depression. And I remember feeling like, excuse me, I'm sorry, what? How dare you? That is so cruel. That is so invalidating. That made me even more depressed. And here I am this week. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to go to the gym depressed. I'm going to do it. I'm going to go to the gym depressed. I'm going to do these things. I'm going to write this post, whatever. I'm going to do it depressed. And no one could have told me that. That had to come from like my own autonomous, I don't know, wisdom inside of me. No one could have told me that. And I would have been like, yeah, sounds great. I'm totally on board. Like, it's so true though. Sometimes things just have to happen at exactly the right moment, or you have to hear it at exactly the right moment.
Well, yeah, I think it's partially because like when other people suggest something, it often feels like they're trying to adjust behavior rather than trying to adjust the way that you feel. Whereas when it comes from inside you, you know, it's taking into account how you feel. So when someone says, oh, have you tried yoga? It's like, fuck you. But when you say, hey, you know what would make me feel better today? Maybe a little bit of yoga. Like that's, it feels different. And maybe we're both just PDAers, but I think it's really different. And when
it is,
you know, because so much of autism and ADHD especially have been treated for so long as behavioral conditions when they're not. They are neurodevelopmental disabilities, which is different.
Exactly.
You know, behavior is different in autistic people and ADHD people because our internal experience is so different and it creates different behavior. So anyway,
well, that's
a whole separate tangent, but yeah. Oh my goodness. Okay. So tell me about, I know you said like right now you're practicing some of this radical self-acceptance and everything and radical self-compassion, but tell me about like maybe the first time this happened for you that you were able to really practice it. Like maybe you'd thought of it before, but the first time you were able to go to the gym depressed instead of just thinking, oh, I should just go depressed.
Oh my gosh.
Going.
Yes. For me, I think my experiences started, I don't know how to say it exactly. So I'll just word vomit a little bit as we do, but so my mom passed away when I was very young. So I've never gotten the chance to ask her like, hey mom, what's going on in your brain? Like, do you experience the same things that I do? I never got that opportunity and I wish that I did, but I feel like from what I can remember, my mom had a very similar brain wiring as me. And something she would do, because I've kind of found her scratch paper and her writing, in like our storage and everything, is she would journal. And I would call it a very specific kind of journaling. I call it storm journaling because that's what it feels like to me. And she would just dump and vent and write out all of her dark, right? All of the dark thoughts, all of the dark, terrible, nasty, negative, whatever it is, whatever was going on in her brain, she would write it out. And I remember she gave me my first journal when I was like 6, and she didn't ever like talk to me about her journaling experience, but I feel like that was her way of being like, hey, this is something that helps me. Let me share this tool with you, essentially. And so something that I've done, it was on and off throughout my life, because I was very hesitant toward it, but I would do, you know, storm journaling. I would write my feelings, and I would write how angry and upset and hurt and, you know, all of the swirling around my brain. I would get it on paper. And for the longest time I thought, okay, this is bad, right? Because now I have this journal and it's like dark and ugly. And I look back at it, it makes me feel bad.
What if someone finds it?
Oh my gosh, yes. What if
someone finds it? Oh, it's my biggest fucking fear.
Exactly.
Sorry, keep going.
No, 100%. So valid. So real. But it wasn't until after my ADHD diagnosis and kind of putting some things together, and, you know, especially the sort of idea of self-compassion and radical acceptance, of being like, hey, let me just like really lean into this. Let me really, really try this and give it a shot without feeling like, oh no, I shouldn't be doing this, or, oh, this is wrong, or, right, I should have positive, right? I should be reframing my thoughts right now. I should be, you know, this is a cognitive distortion or whatever else, right? I just said, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to fully lean in. And so I let myself just pour it all out on paper. And it felt for the first time in my life that I was validating my brain. I was validating my emotional experience, right? That sort of perspective of I'm going to lean into it. Yep. This is exactly where my brain is right now in this moment. This is exactly how I feel. I'm not going to hold back. I'm not going to try to reframe it. I'm not going to try to, I don't know, whatever, change my thinking. I'm just going to, bam, here it is. And I felt so much validation doing that, of like, wow, yeah, this is exactly how I feel. This is real. And in that moment of validation, it felt like it really did something for me. Right now, I wasn't trying to, because I just feel like my whole life with my big emotions, people have tried to be like, hey, like, you should think differently, or hey, your life's not so bad, or I don't know, you shouldn't be feeling this way, is basically the lesson in the story and the narrative that I've been told. And so for the first time in my life, truly validating my emotional experience, to be like, it's not necessarily that this is true, right? I'm not saying that my storm brain thoughts are true or real, but they make sense. It's valid that I'm feeling it. It makes sense that I'm feeling it in this moment. Right? Not that I have to be reactive, right? But I can be reflective, and I can hold space for how I'm feeling. That for me, like leaning into that, I probably did it when I was maybe 29. That for me was the moment where I was like, ooh, this is a game changer. Like, this is really exactly what I needed, because my whole life people were trying to fix it or try to change how I feel. And then I try to change how I feel. And that's not what I need at first. Right. And that's why so many tools do not work for me. Right. I'm trying to remember the, like, tapping, right? Or doing a self-hypnosis, or doing a meditation, or whatever kind of tools for nervous system regulation do not work for me unless I first validate my emotional experience. And that's why so often when I think, oh, I'm feeling like crap, I should use a tool, my brain's like, nah, I don't want to. And it's often because step one for me is the foundation of self-validation. And then I can problem solve, and then I can troubleshoot.
Because using a tool feels like saying you're broken and you need fixing.
Exactly.
The tool.
Yes, exactly. Right.
Yeah. I'm curious, with the PDA and everything, how has opposite action worked for you? Has that been effective, or like hard no? Or
for me, not really. For me personally, not really at all. It's been a hard no. I don't know if it's been a hard no for me, but I think, again, how my brain is wired, when I first validate my experience, because I just have such a shame-based ingraining in me of like, I shouldn't be feeling this way, or what I'm doing is wrong, or like, I should be more productive, or why haven't I done this thing yet? Or when I'm in freeze, just like panicking at the fact that I am in freeze. And so often for me, right, how does Brené Brown say it? Like, something along the lines of like, when you speak shame out loud, it dies. That's like a rough translation of something that she said. But that has been my experience for me, is I have to speak my shame out loud, even if it's to myself, even if it's through journaling or just typing on notes app on my phone, you know, talking to a friend, whatever it might be. And usually from there, that is enough self-validation for me to be like, okay, yeah, I think I'm ready to do this thing that I want to do. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. I just ask because I find opposite action has been a really dynamic tool in my life in the sense that like it used to be really invalidating because it felt like it was saying, oh, you feel this way. How about you just act completely differently and ignore that bullshit? I was like, excuse me, how is this a therapy tool?
Yeah.
So that's how it felt for a long time. Whereas now I kind of love opposite action because I interpret it differently. Instead of saying feelings are how you feel and then actions like are separate or whatever, and like you're supposed to take the opposite action of your feeling, instead the way I frame it is like, no, you feel what you feel and that's fine, but what is the action those feelings are pushing you towards, and what is the opposite of that action that you could maybe try? Mm-hmm. And like that is way more helpful because like my feelings are like, you should eat chocolate chips and cry and stare at the wall for 3 hours and do nothing. And I'm like, yeah, but I just have a feeling that's not going to make me feel better. Weirdly, I'm not convinced. And so it's like, okay, what's the opposite of eating chocolate chips and staring at the wall? I'm like, okay, let's do something engaging. Like, but I can't engage. I'm too sad. And it's like, well, okay, but let's try. And then if it sucks after 10 minutes, then you can stare at the wall. That's fine. Yeah. But give it a 10-minute go.
Yeah, that makes sense. That totally makes sense. I feel like the way that I approach it is maybe a little hop, skip, and a jump over there. I feel like for me, what helps me get there is, what are the words for it? A sort of, right after I've kind of feel like, yep, hey, Tina, your experience makes sense. Your feelings make sense. You make sense. I'll kind of go, well, I'll ask myself the question, like, well, how do I want to feel instead? And asking myself that question kind of then prompts like, well, what does that look like? Or if there is a sensation going on in my body, maybe there's like a tightness here or pressure here or tension here. Like what has to happen to that tension in order for it to change? And kind of visualizing that or seeing myself, okay, if how do I want to feel instead? Okay, what would it look like if I felt this way instead? And a sort of mental visualization and maybe even a mental rehearsal of like, all right, I'm going to see myself walking into the gym and like really killing my lift today and like really getting it or whatever else. Sometimes I'll do that, but it really depends. I very much gauge it on accessibility and maybe like my brain's consent because I don't know. I just feel like if I force myself to do things sometimes, it creates that demand avoidant, maybe negative emotional memory where I'm like, hey, we did that. We did that before. Danger, scary. Let's not do that again. So I have to be really kind of careful walking that line.
Yeah. Okay. I have a question for you about like radical self-acceptance and whatnot. So I've noticed that you tend to speak about your brain the same way that I tend to speak about my brain, which is like me and my brain. Like we're different, you know, we're separate entities. I guess I'm just wondering, like, do you see a way that we can have that dynamic and still have like self-compassion, or like, is it necessary to integrate the two? Cause like, I've had a lot of people in my life, you know, my partner, my therapists who are like, no, you're a person with agency. Like your brain is not this separate thing. And I'm like, okay, but like it is though.
Yes. Yes. So how I see it is, I feel like maybe the way that I phrase it this way is because I feel like I'm trying to create a relationship with my brain. Mm-hmm. Like I am trying to build, cultivate, protect, foster, and cultivate, I don't know, whatever, a relationship with my brain. A collaborative, cooperative relationship of like mutual support, right? And like, I guess the thing that's coming to mind is so often in my life, I have had no idea what my needs are, right? If somebody asks me, hey, what do you need right now? I'll be like, I don't know. I don't know what I need. What do you mean? What do I need? I know what you need. I could tell you all day long about what you need and what's going to make you happy, what's going to make you feel good. But what do I need? Ooh, And I might have little flurries of thoughts of like, oh, maybe this would be like, oh no, but I can't say that. I can't tell them out loud because what if they don't want to do that? Like, I don't want to take away their autonomy and their, you know, power on their life, right? And what they're doing. And so like, that's always the direction that my brain is going in. And oh my gosh, I'm like, I went on a tangent. Hold on, reel me back in. Where were we?
I had a thought as well on the tangent. I think it's also an autistic thing to be like, is it normal to want what I want? Am I going to say this? Are they going to stare at me like an alien? Like, am I allowed to want yes. this? Or am I going to out myself as a weirdo again if I say this? So like, exactly. there's that too. But I think you were talking about the relationship between your brain, making it collaborative.
There
and
we go.
Yeah.
Yes, there we go. Exactly. And so I felt for so much of my life that like, I don't have needs, or if I do have them, I have no idea what they are. I'm so disconnected with them. And so this sort of framework of like, hey brain, like, how are you feeling? Hey brain, what do you need right now in this moment? Sort of helps me. It's sort of, I've heard this. Oh, this is so random. This is really random. But I have a client who's a therapist, and she was talking to me about a therapeutic practice for children where a lot of times, child therapists will say, not how do you feel, well, young child, but how does your bear feel, right? How does your little stuffed animal bear feel about the situation? And what that does is it helps kids feel safe. They're like, yeah. Oh, now it's not on me. You know, my parents not gonna get mad at me, or this person's gonna be disappointed in me, but you know, I can kind of speak for the bear and how the little teddy bear is feeling. And that is a way to create safety. And I feel like it's the same exact phenomenon for me when I talk about my brain as being this like external buddy of mine, this partner, this collaborator of mine, is it helps me feel safer to be like, yeah, what do I need right now in this moment?
Yeah, it's like healthy dissociation, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Like, I'm not even sure if that's a thing, but I feel like it is. But yes. At least for autistic and other neurodivergent people, like, I think there's a certain degree of like, I have to separate from my brain at least a little bit, because my brain, like, isn't, I don't want to say isn't always reliable, because that's an old thought of mine that I'm working on, because I don't think that's true. I think my brain is reliable, but my brain has frequently been judged. It's been judged so hard that it was like forced out of me, and now we're separate. And like, maybe integrating that should be a goal, but maybe not. Maybe it's okay to like be buddies with your brain, and like, yeah, maybe it's different. It's not a neurotypical thing to do. This would explain why I always think of myself as like a plural. Like, yeah. I'm like, oh, we, you know, me, all of them. yeah.
I love, you know, that. Another thing is also, right, self-monitoring is a part of our executive functions. And I feel like that already being a challenge, maybe there's something about like, okay, brain, like, hey, brain, like that being more external that allows us to be more objective or curious. Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. And I've also found that like the executive function struggles can be on the low end, but they can also be on the high end. You know, like, I think a lot of neurodivergent people struggle with self-monitoring because they like struggle to self-monitor at all, and they're not sure what's going on. But I think a lot of neurodivergent people struggle with self-monitoring because it's on high alert all the time. We are so aware of everything that we need and are and all this stuff that it's like, how, there's no room for anything else. And that's exhausting. Yes. That's a whole other struggle, you know?
Yes. Yes. Which leads to that, those moments of being like, oh yeah, I'm like very self-aware. I'm very introspective. And then having these massive blind spots that we tend to have, like, oh, this has been happening for the last 3 months and I had no idea. Okay, cool.
Oh my goodness. Yes. Okay. This is such like a random example, but my husband, this happened literally like 3 days ago. I was saying something. I went to Target and I bought some like curly hair supplies or whatever. And I was like, yeah, you know, it like helps with like the curls or the waves or whatever. And he goes, Megan, your hair is straight. Like, you know that, right? And I'm like, no, no, I genuinely thought it was like, what do you mean? You can see me. This is pretty straight. Like, I just, oh my gosh, there are so many weird, weird blind spots that we have. Like, I remember this was years ago now, but when my husband first told me that I had dealt with a lot of black and white thinking, I was so pissed. I was so mad. Like, what do you mean?
Yeah.
like, anyway, it was, that leads to a whole bunch of talk we could have about stigmatizing, you know, neurodevelopmental conditions that lead to black and white thinking. But anyway, there's a reason I thought that was such a bad thing. But like, it's so weird to have people inform you on these blind spots, because like, it feels very strange.
Agreed.
My hair is straight. What the heck?
It's a weird brain, weird life experience to be like, oh, like, I don't know. I just remember there were so many times at work I would be doing something a certain way because it's the way that I'd always done it. And then someone would be like, hey, did you know? I used to work at a lab. So like, I'd have a colleague come in and like see me, you know, doing something or pipetting something and being like, hey, did you know you could do it this other way? And I'd be like, no, I didn't know that. That would have helped me. I wish I had, because it'd make my life so much easier. But it's just so interesting that we have those moments. And I don't know. I feel like for me, like, it's always felt like my brain is very template based. And if I don't have a template for it, or if I haven't researched a template for it, or I haven't seen a template for it, I won't know. Like, oh, that exists.
Yeah. Oh, that's such a good way of putting it. It's almost like, I don't know if you're like a metaphor autistic, but I'm a pretty heavy metaphor autistic. I feel like when it comes to literal thinking in autistic folks, it's not that we take everything literally. It's that we need a very strict worldview. And some people lean towards like, everything is what it is. And other people are like, everything is like something else.
Yeah.
But to go with like a metaphor for that, it's almost like our brains need the program installed in order to run the specific file. And yep. If the program's not installed, the file doesn't compute at all.
Exactly. That's exactly the feeling. You nailed it 100%.
Okay, good. I'm so glad. Oh my goodness. This has been such a great conversation. So we are going to wrap things up though. For our attentively challenged folks who are listening and maybe zoned out for a minute, could you maybe recap like your favorite thing we talked about, or one thing you want to make sure people take away?
Yeah. One thing I want to make sure people take away is, right, like, it is safe to do less. It is safe to do less. And that doesn't mean, haha, I'm tricking myself, I'm going to do less because I'm secretly tricking myself to be able to do more. Like, no. It is safe for you to do less, like a lot less. And creating that safety and protecting and preserving that safety is going to lead to sustainable, persistent change over the long run, instead of this, like, you know, our hot little, we do a lot and then we burn out and crash and burn and then like don't do the things that we want to do for like 3 years. So make it safe to truly, truly, truly do less. Make a plan in your brain to do less. And also, if you have been a person who experiences a lot of emotional dysregulation, check out Radical Self-Acceptance. And the idea that you are not broken and you are worthy and you always have been.
Yes, I love it. Okay. Well, if people want more Tina goodness, where can they follow you?
Yeah, I am mostly on Instagram these days and my handle is Comfort and Kindness. I'm also on TikTok, but I haven't been posting on TikTok very much lately, but I have a lot of really good juicy videos over on there and it's the same handle. It's also Comfort and Kindness.
Awesome. I love that. Okay. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom. I think people are going to get a ton out of this episode. Everybody go send Tina your DMs and thank her for being here. And yeah, just thank you so much. And to everybody listening, I will talk to you next Saturday. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I really hope that you enjoyed it. If you did, I would so appreciate it if you would leave a review or a rating or whatever it is that you can do on the platform you're listening on. It really helps get the podcast out to other people who need to hear it. So again, thank you for listening. Thank you for the review if you decide to leave one, and I will see you next time.